would have forgotten that there were others who were not warmed or fed. He was so happy that he would not think of any sorrowful thing, and if sometimes in the dark dawns now he remembered that still his father might have power over him, he put the thought away, because he trusted to the lady's resourcefulness and care for him. Now these poor of whom Mung must talk brought an old shadow over him again, and he drew away from shadows. Yet through such talk Yuan learned to see his country as he had not. In those days in the old earthen house he saw it as spreading lovely lands. He saw the fair body of his country. Even then he had not deeply felt the people. But here in these city streets, Mung taught him how to see the country's soul. Through the younger lad's angry notice of every smallest slight put on any lowly man or laborer, Yuan learned to notice too. Since always where the very rich are, there are the very poor too, Yuan, as he came and went upon the streets, saw many more of these, for most were poor. The poorest starving children, blind and foul with disease and never washed, and in the fairest, brightest streets, faced on both sides with great shops of every sort of merchandise, and fluttering silken banners overhead, and hired musicians to play in balconies and draw their crowds of purchasers. Even on these streets the filthiest beggars whined and wailed, and most faces were too pale and thin, and there were scores of prostitutes who came out even ahead of night to ply their hungry trade. He saw everything, and in the end this notice went far deeper in him than it could in Mung, for Mung was one of those who must serve some cause, who bend everything to serve the cause. Whenever he saw a starved man, or if he saw the poor clustered at the gate where rotten eggs are thrown outside the gates of factories, where eggs are sent in ships to foreign lands, and these poor buying bowlfuls for a penny and drinking down the stuff, or if he saw men straining at great loads too heavy even for beasts, or if he saw rich and idle men and silk-clad painted women laughing and taking pleasure while the poor begged, then his anger burst from him, and for everything he felt, he had this cry for cure. "These things will never be better until our cause is gained. We must have revolution. We must have all the rich thrown down, and these foreigners who force us cast out again, and the poor shall be lifted up, and only revolution can do it. Yuan, when will you see this light and join our cause? We need you. Our country needs us all." And Mung turned his burning, angry eyes on Yuan as though he would fasten them in him until he gave his promise. But Yuan could not promise, because he feared the cause. It was the same cause, after all, from which he had escaped. And Yuan could not somehow trust to any cause to cure these ills, nor could he hate a rich man hot and properly as Mung could. The very plumpness of a rich man's body, the ring upon his finger, the fur lining of his coat, the jewels in his lady's ears, the paint and powder on her face, could send Mung wildly deeper in his cause. But even against his will, Yuan must see a kindly look if it were on a rich man's face, or he could see a look of pity in a painted woman's eyes, who gave a bit of silver to a beggar, even though she wore a satin coat. And he liked laughter, whether it was from rich or poor. He liked the one who laughed even if he knew him evil. The truth was, Mung must love or hate men for being white or black, but Yuan could not for his life say, "This man is rich and evil, and this man is poor and good." And so he was spoiled for any cause-making, however great the cause. He could not even hate as Mung hated them the foreigners who mingled with the city crowds, for the city, being very great in trade with all parts of the world, was filled with foreigners of every hue and tongue. And anywhere upon the streets Yuan saw them, some gentle, but some loud and evil and often drunken, and many poor and rich among them. If Mung hated any rich man worse than others, it was rich foreigners. He could bear any cruelty better than this. If he saw a drunken foreign sailor kick a rickshaw puller, or a white woman buying something from a vendor and bent on paying less than she was asked, or if any of those common sights that may be seen in any coastal city where men of every nation meet and mingle. Meng grudged these foreigners the very air they lived upon. If he passed one, he would not give way a foot of path before him. His long, sour lad's face grew darker still, and he would thrust his shoulders out. And if he pushed the foreigner, even though a woman, from his way, then so much the better. And he muttered full of hate, "They have no business on our land. They come to rob and plunder us. With their religion they rob our souls and minds, and with their trade they rob us of our goods and money." One day Yuan and Meng, walking home from school together, passed upon the street a slight, slender man whose skin was white, and his nose high as white men's are, but his eyes and hair were very black and not like white men's. Then Meng cast the man a furious look, and he cried to Yuan, "If there is a thing I hate above another in this city, it is such men as these who are nothing holy, but are mixed in blood, and untrustworthy and divided in their hearts. I never can understand how any of our race can so forget himself, man or woman, as to mix his blood with blood of foreigners. I would kill them all for traitors, and kill such fellows as the one we passed." But Yuan must remember the man's gentle look, and how his face was patient in spite of paleness, and he said, "He looked kind enough. I cannot think he must be evil only because his skin is pale and his blood mixed. He cannot help what his parents did." But Meng cried out, "You ought to hate him, Yuan. Have you not heard what white men have done to our country, and how they hold us hard as any prisoners with their cruel, unjust treaties? We cannot even have our laws. Why, if a white man kills a countryman of ours, he is not punished scarcely. He will not go before our court." While Meng cried out thus, Yuan listened, smiling half an apology, because he was so mild before the other's heat, and feeling perhaps it was true he ought to hate for country's sake, but he was not able. Therefore Yuan could not yet join Meng's cause. He said nothing when Meng begged him, smiled in his shy way, and could not say he would not, but he put forth the reason that he was so busy. He had no time for even such a cause, and at last Meng let him be, and even ceased to talk with him, and gave him but a surly nod or two in passing. On holidays and patriotic days, when all must go forth with flags and singing, Yuan went too, as they all did, lest he be cried a traitor, but he joined no secret meetings, and he made no plots. Sometimes he heard some news of those who plotted, how this one had been found with a bomb hidden in his room to throw at some great man. And once a band of plotters went and beat a certain teacher whom they hated for his friendship with the foreigners. But when he heard such things, Yuan turned more steadfastly to his books, and would not lend his interest elsewhere. Chapter 8. The truth was, at this time Yuan's life was pressed too full for him to know what any one thing was at bottom. Before he could think clearly to the end of rich and poor, or before he could comprehend the meaning of Meng's cause, or even take his full of gaiety, some other thing came to his mind. There was all he knew at school, the many things he learned and did, the strange lessons that he had, the magic of a science opening to him in a laboratory. Even in the chemistry he hated because its stinks offended the delicacy of his nose, he was charmed by the hues of potions that he made, and wondered at the way two mild, passive fluids cast together could suddenly foam up into a new life, new color and new odor, and so make a different third. Into his mind these days there poured every sort of thought and perception of this great city where the whole world met, and there was not time in day and night to see what each one meant. He could not give himself to any single knowledge because there were so many. And in his heart sometimes he envied his cousins and his sister very much, for Sheng lived in his dreams and loves, and Meng lived in his cause, and Ailan in her prettiness and pleasure. And to Yuan this seemed easy living, since he lived in such diversity. Even these city poor were so unlovely in their poverty that Yuan could not feel them wholly pitiful. He did pity them, and he did want them fed and clothed. And nearly always, if he had a penny and a beggar laid his claws upon Yuan's arm, he gave the penny. But he feared he gave it not all in pity either, but partly to buy his freedom from that filthy, clinging hand, and from the whining voice beside his ear,
"Have a kind heart, young sir. A kind heart, sir, lest I starve, I and my children."
There was only one more hideous sight than a beggar in this city, and it was their children. Yuen could not bear the puling children of the very poor, their little faces set already in the whining look of beggary, and worst of all were starveling babes, half naked and thrust into the naked skinny bosoms of the women. Yes, Yuen drew shudderingly from them all. He threw his pennies at them and averted his eyes and hastened on his way. And to himself he thought, "I might join Meng's cause if they were not so hideous, these poor." Yet there came something, too, to save him from complete estrangement from these of his own people, and it was his old love of lands and fields and trees. In the city during the winter that love receded and Yuan often forgot it. But now, as spring drew on, he felt a recklessness come on him. The days grew warm, and in small city gardens the trees began to bud and leaf, and on the streets came vendors carrying on their poles' ends baskets of blossoming plum trees, twisted into dwarfish shapes, or great round bunches of violets and spring lilies. Yuen grew restless in the mild spring winds, and these winds made him remember the little hamlet where the earthen house stood, and he had a craving in his feet to stand on earth somewhere instead of on the city pavements. So he entered his name in the new spring term into a certain class of that school, where teachers taught of cultivation of the land, and Yuen, among others, was apportioned a little piece of earth outside the city, for practice at the land to test what they had learned in books. And in this bit of land it was part of Yuen's task that he must plant seeds and keep the weeds out and do labor of this sort. It so happened that the piece Yuen had was at the end of all the others, and next to a farmer's field. And the first time Yuen came out to see his plot of land he went alone, and the farmer stood there staring, his face alight with grinning, and he shouted, "What are you students here? I thought students only learned in books." Then Yuen answered, "In these days we learn in books of sowing and reaping too, and we learn how to make the land ready for the sowing, and that is what I do today." At this the farmer laughed loudly and said with a mighty scorn, "I never did hear of such a learning. Why, farmer tells his son, and his son tells his son. One looks only at his neighbor and does what his neighbor does." "And if the neighbor is wrong?" said Yuen, smiling. "Then look at the next neighbor, and a better one," said the farmer. And then he laughed over again and fell to hoeing in his own field. And he muttered to himself and stopped to scratch his head and shake himself and laugh again and cry out, "No, I never did hear such a thing in all my days. Well, I'm glad I sent no son of mine to any school to waste my silver to have him learn of farming. I'll teach him more than he can learn, I'll swear." Now Yuen had never held a hoe in his two hands in all his life, and when he took up the long-handled, clumsy thing, it felt so heavy that he could not wield it. However high he lifted it, he could not bring it down in such a way as to cut the packed soil, and it always came down sideways, and he sweat most fearfully, and still he could not do it. So that although the day was cold for spring and biting windy, his sweat was pouring down him as though it were summer. At last, in despair, and secretly, he glanced at the farmer to see how he did it, for the farmer's steady strokes went up and down and made a mark each time the hose point fell, although Yuen hoped the farmer would not see him glance, for indeed he was a little proud. But soon he saw that the farmer did see him, and had seen him all along, and was laughing in himself to see the wild way Yuen flung his hoe about. Now, catching Yuen's glance, he roared with fresh laughter, and striding over clods, he came up to Yuen and cried, "Never tell me you are watching what a neighbor farmer does, when you have learned it all in books." And he laughed and cried again, "Has not your book told you even how to hold the hoe?" Then Yuen struggled a little over a petty anger, for to his own surprise he found it was not easy for him to hear the laughter of this common man, and he had his own rueful knowledge that indeed he could not even dig this bit of land, and how could he hope to plant the seed in it? But his reason overcame his shame at last, and he let his hoe drop, and he grinned, too, and bore the farmer's laughter, and wiped his dripping face, and said sheepishly, "You are right, neighbor. It is not in the book. I'll take you for my teacher, if you'll let me learn of you." At this simple speech the farmer was very pleased, and he liked Yuen, and he stopped his laughing. In truth, he was secretly proud that he, a humble farmer, had something he could teach this young man, a youth from the schools, as anyone could see, and learned in his speech and looks. And so, importantly and with a sort of pompousness upon him, the farmer eyed the young man and said seriously, "First, look at me and look at yourself, and ask which one is free to wield the hoe without much sweating." And Yuen looked and saw the farmer, a man strong and brown, stripped to the waist, his legs bare to his knees, his feet in sandals, his face brown and red with winds and weather, his whole look good and free. Then Yuen said nothing, but he smiled, and without a single word he took off his outer heavy coat and then his inner coat, and rolled his sleeves up to his elbow and stood ready. This the farmer watched, and suddenly he cried again, "What woman's skin you have! Look at this arm of mine!" And he put his arm by Yuen's, and outstretched his hand. "Put out your hand! Look at your palm, all blisters! But you hold your hoe so loosely it would have rubbed a blister even on my hand!" Then he picked up the hoe and showed Yuen how to hold it in his two hands, the one hand firm and close to keep the handle sure, and the other farther on to guide the swing of it. And Yuen was not ashamed to learn, and he tried many times until at last the iron point fell true and hard, and clipped away a piece of earth each time it fell. And then the farmer praised him, and Yuen felt as glad as he did if he had a verse praised by his teacher, although he wondered that he did, seeing that the farmer was but a common man. Day after day Yuen came to work upon his plot of land, and he liked best to come when all his fellows were not there, for when they came the farmer would not draw near at all, but worked in some more distant field of his. But if Yuen were alone, he came and talked, and showed Yuen how to plant his seed, and how to thin the seedlings when they sprang up, and how to watch for the worms and insects that were eager and ready always to devour each seedling as it came. And Yuen had his turn in teaching, too, for when such pests came he read and learned of foreign poisons that would kill them, and he used these poisons. The first time he did this the farmer laughed at him and cried out, "Remember how you watched me after all, and how your books have not come true, nor showed you how deep to lay your beans, or when to hoe them free of weeds?" But when he saw worms shrivel up and die upon the bean plants under the poison, then he grew grave and wondering, and said in a somewhat lower tone, "I swear I would not have believed it. So it is not a thing willed by gods, these pests. It is something man can do away with. Something there is in books after all. Yes, more than a little even, I can say, because planting and sowing are of no use if worms devour the plants." Then he begged some poison for his own land, and Yuen gave it gladly. And in such giving these two became friends after a fashion, and Yuen's plot was best of all, and for this he thanked the farmer, and the farmer thanked Yuen that his beans throve and were not eaten as his neighbor's fields were. It was well for Yuen to have this friend, and to have this bit of land to work upon. For often in the springtime, as he bent himself upon the earth, some content rose up in him, which he had never known. He learned to change his clothes and wear a common garb such as the farmer wore, and even to change his shoes to sandals, and the farmer let him be free in his home, for he had no unwed daughter, and his wife by now was old and ugly, and Yuen kept his clothes for work there. So every day he came he changed himself into a farmer, and he loved the earth more even than he thought he would. It was good to watch for seeds to sprout, and there was a poetry in it, too, a thing he scarcely could express, although he tried to do it and made a verse about it. He loved the very labor of the land, and when his own was done, he often went and labored on the farmer's land, and sometimes at the farmer's asking he would eat a meal on the threshing floor, where as the days grew warmer, the farmer's wife would spread the table. And he grew hard and brown, until Ilon cried at him one day,
Yuan, how is it you grow blacker every day? You are as black as any farmer.
Then Yuan grinned and answered, So I am a farmer, Ailan, but you never will believe me when I say so. For often at his books, or even in the midst of an evening's pleasure, when he was far away from that bit of land, it came suddenly to his mind, and while he read or while he played, he planned some new seed he could sow, or he would wonder if perhaps a vegetable he had would be fit for gathering before the summer came, or he would be troubled because he remembered a yellow withering beginning upon a plant's tip. To himself, Yuan thought sometimes, If all the poor were like this one man, then I might be willing to join Meng's cause and make it mine. It was well that Yuan had this solid and secret content in this little plot of land lent him. It was secret, for not if he would could he have told anyone why he liked to work on land. And at this time of his youth he was even a little ashamed of this liking, because it was the fashion of these city youths to laugh at countrymen, and call them louts and big turnips, and many names like these. And Yuan cared what his fellows said. Not even to Sheng, therefore, could he speak of this, though with Sheng he could talk of many things, such as a beauty they both saw in a sudden color or shape somewhere. Still less to Ailan could he have told what strange, deep, solid pleasure he had in this bit of land. He might have spoken, if there had been need to tell, to this one whom he called his mother, for though they did not speak much of inward things, still at the meal-times they had alone in the house, the lady did talk often, in her grave way, of things she liked to do. For this lady was full of quiet, good works, and she did not give herself over completely to gaming or feasting, or going to see running horses and dogs, as many ladies did in this city. These were not pleasures to her, although if Ailan wished it, she went with her, and sat and watched it all, apart and elegant, and as though it were a duty and nothing to be done for its own sake. Her real pleasure was in a certain good work she did for children, those female children newly born, who were cast away unwanted by the poor. These, when she found them, she gathered into a home she kept, and she hired two women to be mothers to them, and she herself went there daily too, and taught them, and watched to see those who were ill or wasted, and she had nearly 20 of these little foundlings. Of this good work she talked to Yuan sometimes, and how she planned to teach these girls some good honest livelihood, and wed them to such honest men as might be found, farmers or tradesmen or weavers, or whatever man might want good working maids. Once Yuan went with her to the home, and he was amazed to see the change that came upon this grave, staid lady. It was a poor, plain place, for she had not much money to spend there, since even for these she would not rob Ailan of any pleasure. But once within the gate, the children fell upon her, crying out she was their mother, and they pulled her dress and hands and loved her eagerly, until she laughed and looked shyly at Yuan, and he stood staring, for he had not seen her laugh before. "Does Ailan know of them?" he asked. At this the lady was suddenly grave again, and nodded, saying only, "She is busy with her own life now." And then she led Yuan here and there about the plain home. From court to kitchen all was clean, though poor, and she said, "I do not want much money for them, for they are to be the wives of working men." To this she added presently, If I find one, even one, among them, who might be what I plan for Ailan, I will take her apart then to my own home and spend myself upon her. I think there is this one, I do not know yet. She called, and a child came out to her from another room, a child older than the rest, a child of a certain gravity of look, although not more than 12 or 13 years of age. She came with confidence and put her hand into the lady's hand, and looked at her, and said in a clear voice, Here I am, my mother. This child, the lady said, most earnestly, looking down into the child's upturned face, has some spirit in her, but I do not yet know what it is. I found her my own self laid at this door, when she was newborn, and I took her in. She is the eldest and the first I found. She is so quick at letters, so true to every teaching, so to be depended on, that if she continues thus, I shall take her to my own home within a year or two. So, Mei Ling, you may go." The child gave her a smile, a quick, lightning smile, and she threw Yuan a deep look. And though she was only yet a child, Yuan did not forget the look. It was so clear and questioning. Straightly put, not as though to him more than to another. Then she went away again. To such a lady, then, Yuan might have spoken. But there was no need for speech, after all. He only knew he liked the hours he put upon the land. They joined him to some root he had, so that he was not, as were many others, rootless and floating upon the surface of the life in this city. Again and yet again, Yuan, when he suffered unrest or questioning of some sort, went to this bit of land, and there, sweating in the sun or wet with cool rain, he worked in silence or talked quietly of common things with his neighbor farmer. Although such work, such talk, seemed nothing or of no great import of any kind while it was being done, yet when night came Yuan could go home, and he was cleansed and freed of all inward impatience. He could read in his books and meditate upon them happily, or he could go with Ailan and her friends, and spend the hours in noise and light and dancing, and not be disturbed, having in himself some quietness he learned upon his land. And he well needed this quietness the land gave him, the steadiness and root it gave him, for in this spring his life was given a twist he had not dreamed it could be given. In one thing Yuan was very far behind Sheng, and very far behind Ailan, and behind even Meng. These three lived in a warmer air than Yuan ever had. In this great city they had spent their youth, and all its heats poured into their blood. There were here 100 heats for youth, the pictures of love and beauty painted on the walls, the pleasure houses where the pictured loves of strange men and women in foreign lands were shown, the halls of dancing, where for a little silver a woman may be bought for a night. These were the crudest heats. Above these somewhat were the printed tales and stories and verses of love that could be found for sale in any little shop. In the old days these were counted all for evil, and understood for what they were, a torch to light the fires in man or maid, and none could read them openly. But now, on this day, the subtlety of outer nations had crept in, and under guise of art and genius and such fair names, the young read these writings everywhere and studied them. Yet for all the fairness of the names, the torch was there still, and the old fires were lighted. Young men grew daring, and maids too, and old modesties were gone. Hands touched, and it was not counted evil as it used to be, and a youth himself might ask a maid to be betrothed to him, and her father did not sue his father in a court of law as once he might, and still would in an inland city where the evil ways of foreigners were unknown. And when the two were openly betrothed, they came and went as freely as though they were savages. And if sometimes, as it must happen, blood ran too hot and high and flesh met flesh too soon, then the two were not killed for honor's sake, as would have happened in their parents' youth. No, only the marriage day was hastened forward, and so the child was born in wedlock, and the young pair were as careless as though they both were honorable, and parents, if they were miserable, could but look at each other in sick privacy and bear it as they could, for this was the new day. But many a father cursed the new day for his son's sake, and the mother for her daughter's sake. But still this was the new day, and none could turn it back. In this day Sheng had lived, and Meng his brother, and Ailan too, and they were part of it and did not know another. But Yuan was not so. Him the tiger had reared in every old tradition, and in his own added hatred of all women. And Yuan had never dreamed of women, even. Or if inadvertently he did dream in his sleep, he woke in hottest shame at it, and sprang out of bed and fell to furious labor on his books, or else he walked the streets a while, or did some such thing to clear his mind of evil. Some day, he knew, he must wed as all men did, and have his sons in decency. but it was not a thing to think of when he had so much to learn. He craved learning only now. He had plainly told his father, and he was not changed yet. But in the spring of this year, he was harassed with nightly dreaming, plagued by dreams. It was the strangest thing, for by day he never let his thoughts go to love or women. Yet his thoughts asleep were filled with such lewdness that he awoke and sweat with shame, and he was cleansed only when he went striding to his bit of land and worked there desperately. And on the days when he could work there longest, in the nights of such dreams, he dreamed the least and slept the sweetest. So he turned yet more ardently to labor there. Now, although he did not know it, Yuen was as hot as any youth within, and hotter far than Cheng, who diffused his heart into 100 petty languors, and hotter too than Meng, who had his cause to burn for. And Yuen had come out of the cold courts of his childhood into this heated city. He, who had never even touched a maid's hand, could not yet put his arm about a maid's slight body and hold her hand in his with no rebuke, and feel her breath upon his cheek, and move her as he would to sounds of music, without the sweet sickness in him which he loved and feared. And though he was decorous, until Ailan teased him without pity, and he scarcely touched the hand he held, and never rested the maid's body against his own, as many men were eager to do, and did it unreproved, too, still Ailan's very teasing set his thoughts moving as they would not have dared to move, and as he wished they would not. She cried sometimes, pursing out her pretty lips, "Yuen, you are so old-fashioned. How can you dance well if you push the girl away from you like that? Look, this is the way to hold a maid." And there in the room where they all sat in the rare evenings when she was home with her mother, she set the music going in its box, and she pressed herself into his arms and let her body follow all the lines of his, her feet weaving in and out with his. And she did not fail to tease him with the other maidens by, too, and she cried laughing, if one were there, "If you would dance with my brother Yuen, you must force him to hold you rightly. What he would like best would be to set you up against a wall somewhere and do his dancing all alone." Or she would say, "Yuen, you are handsome, we all know, but not so fearfully handsome you need to fear every maid. Doubtless there are some of us who have our loves already set." And with such raillery before her friends, she set them all to merriment, so that bold maids grew bolder and pressed themselves against him shamelessly. And though he would have stopped their boldness, he feared the sharp merriment of Ailan's further speech, and bore it as he could. And even timid maids grew smiling when they danced with him, and bolder than they were with bolder men. And they, too, added upturned eyes and smiles, and warmer hand clasps, and the touch of thigh to thigh, and all those wiles which women know by nature. At last he grew so troubled by his dreams and all the freedom of the maids he knew for Ailan's sake that he would never have gone with her again, except that the mother still said so often, "Yuen, it comforts me to know you are with Ailan, even though she has another man to take her where she goes. I feel the better if I know you are there too." And Ailan was willing enough for Yuen to go with her, for she was proud to show him off, for he was a tall youth, and not ill to look at. And there were maids she knew to whom it was a favor that she brought him with her. Thus were the fires ready in Yuen, against his will, but he laid no torch to them. Yet was the torch laid, and in no way he could foresee, nor, indeed, that any could foresee. Chapter 9. And thus it was. One day Yuen lingered in the classroom to write down a foreign poem which his teacher had set upon the wall for a task, and he lingered until every other one was gone, or so he thought. It so happened that this was the class that he and Cheng sat together in, and also that pale maid who was a revolutionist. Now as Yuen finished what he wrote, and closed his book and put his pen into his pocket and stirred himself to rise, he heard his name called, and one spoke thus, "Mr. Wang, since you are here, will you explain to me the meaning of those lines set there? You are more clever than I am. I thank you if you will. This Yuan heard said in a very pleasing voice, a maid's voice, but not tinkling with affection, as even Ailan's voice was, or those of her friends. It was rather somewhat deep for any maid, very full and thrilling in its tone, so that any casual word it spoke seemed to take on more meaning than the mere word had. Yuan looked up in haste and great surprise, and there beside him stood that maid, the revolutionist, her pale face paler still than he remembered it. But now that she stood near him, he saw her dark, narrow eyes were not cold at all, but filled with inward warmth and feeling, and they belied the set coldness of her face, and burned there in its paleness. She looked at him steadfastly, and then with calmness set herself beside him and waited for him to answer, as cool as though she spoke on any day to any man. He somehow answered, stammering while he did,
Yes, of course, only I am not sure. I think it means, foreign verse is always difficult. It is an ode, a sort of...
And so he stammered on, speaking something, somehow, and conscious always of her deep and steadfast look, now on his face, now on the words. And then she rose and thanked him, and again she spoke the simplest words, and yet somehow her voice freighted them with a great load of gratitude, far more, Yuan thought, than any service could deserve. Then naturally they drew together as they left the room and walked together down the silent halls, for it was late afternoon and every student eager to be gone. And so they walked out to the gate, and the maid seemed content to be silent until Yuan asked a thing or two for courtesy's sake. He asked, "What is your honored name?" And he asked in the old-fashioned, courteous way he had been taught. But she answered crisply, the words short and curt, seemingly, and without the return courtesy, except that voice of hers gave meaning to everything she said. At last they reached the gate, and Yuan bowed deeply. But the maid gave a quick nod and went her way, and Yuan, looking after her, saw her a little taller than most women as she walked, sure and swift among the crowds, until he lost her. Then he leaped wondering into a rickshaw and went home, and he wondered what she really was, and wondered at the way her eyes and voice said other things than did her face and words. On this slight beginning a friendship grew. Now Yuan had never had a maid for friend, nor in truth had he many friends, for he had not, as some did, a little special group in which he took a natural place. His cousins had their friends, Sheng his friends among young men like himself, who fancied they were the poets and the writers and the young painters of a modern day, and they followed zealously after leaders, such as the one surnamed Wu, at whom Yuan glanced sidewise while he danced with Ailan. And Meng had his secret group of revolutionists. But Yuan belonged to none, and though he spoke to a score or so of young men as he passed them, and though he knew this maid or that of Ailan's friends to talk lightly with a little while, he had no bosom friend. Before he knew it, this maid came to be his friend. And thus it came about. At first it was always she who pressed the friendship, coming as any wilier maid might do to ask his explanation or his advice on something or other, and he was deceived, as all men easily are, by even such simple wile as this. For after all he was a man and very young, and it was pleasant to him to advise a maid, and he came to helping her to write her essays. And at last it came about that with one excuse or another they met somehow every day, although not openly. For if anyone had asked Yuan what he felt for this maid, he would have said he felt friendship only, nothing more. She was in truth a very different maid from any he thought fair, thought even a little fair, because there was no maid to whom he gave a real thought yet in his life, and to himself, if he meditated on any maid at all, it was to see some pretty flowery maid like Ailan, with little pretty hands and lovely looks and dainty ways. And all these qualities he saw in Ailan's friends. Yet he had not loved one of them. He had only said in his heart that did he ever love, the maid must be pretty as a rose is pretty, or a budded plum flower, or some such delicate, useless thing. So had he written secret verses sometimes to such maids, a line or two and always unfinished, because the feeling was so slight and vague, and there was no one single maid who stood enough to him as the one to write to above all others. It was rather that his love was diffused like a dim coming light before the sunrise. Certainly he never thought of one to love like this maid, severe and earnest and clothed always in her dark straight robes of blue or gray, and wearing leather shoes, and bent always on her books and cause. Nor did he love her now. But she loved him. At which hour he found this out he scarcely knew, yet he knew, too. One day they met at a distance to walk upon a quiet street along a canal's edge, and it was evening and the time of twilight, and they were about to turn homeward, when suddenly he felt her looking at him, and he caught her look, and it was changed. A deep, clinging, burning look it was. And then her voice, her lovely voice that never seemed a part of her, came forth and said, "Yuen, there is one thing I'd rather see than anything." And when he faltered out to know what it was, his heart beating very thickly all of a sudden, although he had not thought of loving her, she said on, "I want to see you in our cause. Yuen, you are my very brother. I want to call you comrade, too. We need you. We need your good mind, your strength. You are twice what Hmong can ever be." Suddenly Yuen thought he saw why she had come to friendship with him, and he thought angrily that she and Hmong had planned it, and his rising feeling checked itself. But then her voice said again, very soft and deep sounding in the twilight, her voice said, "Yuen, there is another reason." And now Yuen dared not ask her what it was, but a faintness in him rose and choked him nearly, and he felt his body tremble, and he turned and said, half whispering, "I must get home. I promised Ailan." And so, with no other word, they both turned and walked homeward. But when they parted, they did that they never had done, scarcely meaning it and certainly not planning so to do. They clasped their hands together, and with that touch some change came into Yuen, and he knew they were no more friends, not now friends any more, though still he did not know what they were. But all that evening when he was with Ailan, when he spoke to this maid, danced with that one, he looked at them as he never had, and puzzled over how maids in the world can be so differing. And that night when he went to bed he lay a long time pondering on this, the first time he had even thought of any maid. For now he thought long of this one maid, and he thought about her eyes, how he had once thought them cold, like dull onyx in the paleness of her face. But now he had seen them brighten into warm beauty of their own when he spoke to her. Then he remembered how her voice was always sweet, and how its richness seemed unsuited to her quietness and seeming coldness. And yet it was her own voice. So, pondering, he wished that he had had courage to ask her what that other reason was. He would have liked to hear her voice tell him such a reason as he guessed. But still, he did not love her. He knew he did not love her. And last he came to the memory of that touch of her hand to his, the heart of her hand pressed against his hand's heart. So, palm to palm, they had stood an instant in the darkness of the unlit street. So fixed a rickshaw swerved to pass them, and they did not see it until the men cursed them, and still they did not care. It had been too dark for him to see her eyes, and she had said nothing, nor had he. There was only that close touch to think on. And when he thought of it, the torch was lit. Something flamed inside him, though what it was puzzled him no little, for still he knew he did not love her. Now if it had been Sheng who touched this maid's hand, he would have, if he liked, smiled and forgotten it, for he had touched many maid's hands warmly for a moment, or if he liked he would have touched it again and yet again, as often as he would if he found the maid loved him, or at least until he wearied of it, and he would have written a tale or two, or made a verse, and then forgotten her the more easily. And Mung would not have dreamed long of it either, for in this cause of his were maids enough, and they made it a purpose, youths and maids, to be bold and free together, and to call each other comrade. And Mung heard much talk, and made some talk too, about men and women being equal always, and free to love each other as they would. Still, with all this freedom, there was not overmuch true freedom, for these maids and youths, as Mung did, burned with another cause than lust, and the cause burned them clean. And Mung was cleanest of them all, for he had grown so filled with loathing of lust, having seen his own father's heat and his elder brother's wandering eyes, that he scorned all vain pastime spent with women, because to him it seemed they wasted mind and body that should be spent for cause. As yet Mung had never touched a maid. He could speak as well as any on free love and rights of love without a rule of marriage, but he did none of it. But Yuen had no burning, cleansing cause. He had not the safety of Sheng's idle, pleasant ways with maidens either. And so when this one maid touched Yuen's hand as none had ever touched it, he could not forget it. Here was a thing to wonder at, too, that this hand of hers, when he remembered it, was hot and moist in the palm. He had not thought her hand could be hot. Thinking of her pale face, of her cool, pale lips that moved so little when she spoke, he would have said, if he had thought of it before, that her hands would be dry and cool, and the fingers loose to hold. But this was not true. Her hand had held to his hand, close and hot and clinging. Hand and voice and eyes, those spoke of her hot heart. And when Yuen began to think what her heart might be, the heart of this strange maid who was so bold and calm, yet shy, as he could know her shy through his own shyness, then he tossed upon his bed and longed to touch her hand again and yet again. Nevertheless, when at last he fell asleep and woke in the cool spring of the morning, he knew he did not love her. He could think in the cool morning and remember how hot her hand was, and say to himself that even so he did not love her. And on that day in the school, in great shyness, he avoided every glance at her, and he did not linger anywhere, and at the earliest hour after noon he went out to his land and worked there feverishly. And to himself he thought, "This feel of earth upon my hands is better than the touch of any maid's hand." And he remembered how he had lain and thought in his head the night before, and he was ashamed and glad his father did not know. Before long the farmer came by, and he praised the clever way Yuen felled the weeds about his turnips, and he laughed and said, "Do you remember that first day you hoed? If it had been today, you would have felled each turnip with the weeds." And he laughed mightily, and then he said to comfort Yuen, "But you will make a farmer yet. It is told in the muscle of your arm and in the bigness of your back. Those other students, such a puny lot of pale weeds I never saw. Their spectacles and dangling little arms and their gold teeth and their sticks of legs stuck into foreign trousers. If I had such bodies as they have, I swear I'd wrap me in robes somehow and hide myself." And the farmer laughed again and shouted, "Come and smoke a while and rest yourself before my door." And so Yuen did. And he listened, smiling, to the farmer's loud, constant voice, and to all the farmer's scorn of city men, and especially did the farmer hate the young men and the revolutionists. And he cried down every mild, good word Yuen said for them, and he shouted, "And what good can they do for me, then? I have my bed of land, my home, my cow. I want no more land than I have, and I have enough to eat. If the rulers would not tax me so hard, I would be glad. But men like me have always been so taxed. Why should they come and talk to me of doing good to me or mine? Who ever heard of good coming out of strangers? Who will do good for any man except those of his own blood? No, I know they have something they want for themselves. My cow, perhaps, or else my bit of land." And then he cursed a while, and cursed the mothers who could bear such sons, and grew merry at the expense of all who were not like himself, and praised Yuen for working on the land so well. And then he laughed, and Yuen laughed, and they were friends. From this robustness and from the cleanness of the earth, Yuen went home again into his bed, and he would not go out that night for any pleasure even, because he wanted nothing of any maid, and he desired to touch no maid at all, but only to do his work and learn his books, and so this night he slept. In this way the land healed him for a time. Yet in him were the flames already lit. Another day or two, and his mood changed itself again, and he was restless, and he turned his head secretly one day to see if that maid were in the schoolroom, and she was. And between the heads of others their eyes met, and her eyes clung to his, although he turned back quickly. But he could not forget her. In a day or two again, he said in passing through the door, although he had not planned it, "Shall we walk together again today?" And she nodded, her deep eyes looking down. That day she did not touch his hand, and it seemed to him she walked farther from him than she used to do, and was more silent, and talk came harder than it did. And here was something contrary in Yuen, which surprised himself. He would have sworn he would be glad not to be touched, and that he did not want her very near. And yet, when they had walked a while, he wished that she had touched him. He would not even at parting put out his hand, and yet he watched and longed to see her hand come forth, so he must meet it. But it did not, and he went home defrauded somehow, and yet angry that he felt so. And he was ashamed, and swore he would not walk with any maid, and that he was a man with work to do. And he astonished a certain mild old teacher that day with his bitter writing of how man ought to live alone, and strive after learning and keep away from women. And that night he told himself 100 times that he was glad he did not love this maid. Each day thereafter for a while he went dogged to his land, and would not let himself remember that he wanted any touch. Then one day, some 3 days after that, he had a letter written in a small, square writing that he did not know. Now Yuen had not many letters, and only one sometimes from a comrade he had loved in the school of war who loved him still. And this letter was not the hasty writing of his friend. He opened it, and there within he found a page from the maid he did not love. A single page, very short, and saying these words clearly, "Have I done something to make you angry with me? I am a revolutionist, a modern woman. I have no need to hide myself as other women have. I love you. Can you then love me? I do not ask or care for marriage. Marriage is an ancient bondage. But if so be you need my love, you have it when you will." And then, very small and cryptic, she twisted close together the shaping of her name. So was love first offered to Yuen. Now must he think of love, sitting in his room alone, this letter in his hand, and he must wonder of all that love could mean. Here was a maid ready for his taking if he would take her. And many times his blood cried out that he might take her. He began to lose his childish youth in those few hours, and manhood grew in him, in rushing heartbeats and in his ardent blood. His body was no more a lad's body now. In a few days the heats within him ripened him, and he was full grown and a man in his desires. But still he wrote no answer to the maid, and at the school he avoided every sight of her. Twice on different nights he sat down to write, and twice beneath his pen the words rose up, "I do not love you." But yet those words he would not write, because his curious body pressed him to let it know what it desired. So in this dark confusion of his blood and heart he wrote no answer, and he waited for himself. But he was sleepless, and more nearly angry and full of impatience than he had ever been before, so that the lady, his mother, looked at him most thoughtfully, and Yuen felt her questioning. Yet he would say nothing. For how could he say that he was angry because he could not take a maid he did not love, and that he was angry because he could not love her since he wanted what she offered him? So he let the struggle wage itself in him, and was as moody as his father ever was when any war was to be waged. Chapter 10. Now out of all this mingled life of Yuen's, wherein he was caught a little in everything and in nothing wholly, The old tiger suddenly forced a clarity, and this without knowing at all what he did. These many months since the lady had written him first, the tiger had not answered anything. He sat there in his distant halls, silent and sulky against his son, and no word came out of him. Once again the lady wrote, and yet again, without telling Yuan she did. And if Yuan asked sometimes why she had no answer from his father, she answered soothingly, "Let be. As long as he says nothing, there can be no ill news." And indeed Yuan was very willing to let be, and every day his mind was more swallowed in his life. And at last he almost forgot that he had anything to fear at all from his father, or that he had run away from his father's power. It seemed so much his life here. Then one day in the later passing spring, the tiger put forth his power again upon his son. He came out of his silence, and he wrote a letter, not to the lady, but to his own son. This letter he did not bid a letter writer write for him either. No, with his own brush, which he had not for long used, the tiger put down a few words to his son. And though the letters were sharply, rudely made, the meaning of them was very plain. They said, "I have not changed my will. Come home and be wed. The day is set for the 30th of this moon." This letter Yuan found waiting for him in his room one night when he came in from an evening's pleasure. He came in all languorous and roused with pleasure, so that almost while he swayed to this music and to that, he had made up his mind that night to take the love the maid had offered to him. He came in filled with this excitement, that the next day, perhaps, or the next day but one, he would go with her where she would and do as she was willing, or at least he played with the thought that so perhaps he would. Then his eye fell upon the table, and there the letter was, and very well he knew the superscription, and who had written it. He seized it and tore the tough old-fashioned paper out of its envelope, and drew the inner paper forth, and there the words were, plain as though he heard the tiger's shout. Yes, the words were like a shout to Yuan.